Chapter 22. The news for which Iceland had been waiting arrived at last. A messenger came from Norway to tell them that Olaf's fleet would bring him there in triumph within a fortnight. Immediately, Theobrand's persecution of his wife and stepson ceased. He still would have enjoyed what he called saving their souls, but the need to prepare a fitting reception for the royal visitor claimed his whole attention. As Olaf's ambassador and herald, the Bonders looked to him to take the lead in great welcome. Without any official decision, by vote or otherwise, it was taken for granted that the feast would be at his house, and that there Iceland would formally acknowledge Olaf's overlordship. Theobrand had another somewhat personal reason for giving special heed to the occasion. Bishop Sigurd, who had ordained him and to who he was accountable, had moved the seat of his bishopric from the Scilly Islands to Norway because of that country's importance as the new Christian center of the north. Sigurd was coming to Iceland with Olaf. This being the first feast held at the house since he became its head, comparisons were sure to be made between the bounty of Helga's second husband and that of her first. That, even more than the need for properly greeting his king and bishop, drove him to wild extravagance. He determined to surpass the feast given by his predecessor, though it ruined him. This policy brought exasperation with it, for every detail suggested the corresponding taste and judgment of the Sea King, until it seemed to really be he who was the host. Furthermore, the profligacy of the preparations ran Theobrand deeply into debt, which he had to assume personally, as the estate was not his to mortgage, but Eric's. He was reasonably sure he would clear himself of this financial burden, custom requiring Olaf to make costly gifts of gold in return for hospitality. But he still worried about the unforeseen, for the reason that it can occur. Having no taste to guide him, but only nervousness, he bought everything which he thought might somehow add to the magnificence. He had golden presents made for all his guests, taking care there should be more than enough so that the very wastefulness would be commented upon. The handsome old tapestries were supplemented by others newly purchased from a Normandy trader. Similar additions were made to the family tableware and to the drinking horns, gold and silver ornamentation being used whenever it was in the least degree fitting, and sometimes when it was not. The most expert wood carver in Iceland was put to work making a high seat for Olaf. The scrollwork depicted his victory over Dalla Gulbrand, with Olaf himself, that is, an idealized notion of him, since the artist had never seen him, standing with his foot on fallen Thor, and at the top a cross, carefully calculated to be neither higher nor lower than the top of Olaf's head, but exactly at the same level. A companion piece was made for Sigurd, a high seat of precisely the same dimensions but with nothing carved on it but a large cross, the contrast emphasizing the single-minded idealism of the church. Sigurd's chair was really the handsomer of the two. There were magnificent, matched horses to carry Olaf and his party from the ships to the house, with saddles and bridles inlaid with silver, and Sicilian brocades for the hangings on all the beds. New straw was laid upon the floor, and outside the door near the road, a huge table was placed, on which there would be food and drink for any and all, whether invited or not. He was undecided what sort of clothes he should wear on such an occasion, weighing two effects against each other, the splendor of the king's representative, or the austerity of the priest. Vanity won. The hose and kirtle which he ordered were of scarlet, with a belt in whose buckle great crystals were set, and about his shoulders he hung a cloak of deep blue, edged with fur and clasped at his neck with a golden chain. He had his hair combed out and let it hang down to his shoulders, while about his forehead was a thin gold circlet. For all that, his deep-set eyes, peering out of his passion-torn face, made him look like what he was, a priest in disguise. When the preparations were complete and as he had ordered, he was still uneasy. He remembered how he had first come to this hall and had coveted it for his king and god. Now it was theirs, with this hall and this island, and he wondered whether they would be grateful. Of his reward in heaven he was sure, and reasonably sure of his bishop's praise. For Olaf's gratitude he had to depend on hope and logic. It would surely be so. Why should it not be? After all, he had earned it. Olaf could not fail to appreciate, and the like. He had gay moments in which he saw himself honored and rewarded, and pompous moments in which he reminded himself that church and crown were partners, and Olaf could not do without him. Ransacking the storehouse for anything ornate he might have overlooked, he found Red Eric's old high seat, with the effigy of Locke on its pillars. He had it placed at the table for himself to sit in. Locke was a heathen demon, but on the bare chance that he still had any power, it might as well work for a good Christian. Helga was extremely pleased to be a hostess again. The grateful activities of ordering the servants about and making sure that invitations were sent were so precisely what she craved that she at once forgot her recent ordeal. Eric was summoned to Theobrand's presence and sternly ordered to try, as well as his evil little heart would let him, to be a credit to his family in the presence of their king, and in the meantime to study his lessons and keep out of the way. Thereafter, he had the forgotten experience of being left to himself. At first, he thought it was a trick, and kept his gaze fixed upon his parchments so that Theobrand could not leap at him suddenly from some hiding place and berate him. When he remained unmolested, he did not know for a while what to do with his freedom. By habit, he actually did go back to reading his lessons, especially those favorite scriptural tales which dealt with murder. But he realized at last that he had a chance to play his old games, of which he had been so long deprived. Still not certain whether he was being watched, he made a false start in a direction which he did not mean to follow. Then, finding that he was indeed alone, he went to the rock which had once been a ship and played at being its master. But the crew was not there and neither was the fun. Next, he tried defying the trolls, but that too was pointless without the companion who used to praise his bravery. All the old games proved disappointing, for they were not as he remembered them. He was thrown back at length upon the new game he had invented, hating Theobrand. He returned to the house and tried to lift the big spear from its wall bracket. After a while, he found he was able to do so by balancing it in the middle of its haft, but he could carry it only by using both hands. Wielding it as a weapon was altogether beyond his strength, so he put it back. At that point, he decided to return to his studies in case he was being spied upon. He was found, reading industriously, by servants who came to get him measured for new clothes. As their real purpose might be tale-bearing, he pretended to object to the interruption. The nervous strain which the great coming event caused in this little family was felt also in many others. Each bonder in Iceland was either hoping or worrying, depending upon his particular nature, and his household duly rejoiced or suffered. All topics of conversation, except what Olaf might or might not do when he came, were passed over quickly. Presently they spoke of nothing else, and were impatient with anybody who tried to. There was too much at stake, too many details to fret about, too many attitudes to consider. What was the best way to make a good impression on a king? More important, a good second impression, a good lasting impression. What sort of manner did Olaf probably prefer? What sort of men? What sort of women? Not only all talk, but all thinking concerned itself solely with what Olaf might like and want, and the best way to get it for him before someone else did. Olaf, Olaf, Olaf. Iceland prepared to abandon everything it had been and be remade according to Olaf's whims. The bishop received much less attention, almost none at all. It was said and recognized that cross and sword were equal in the new state of things, but the sword was what they understood. An uninterrupted watch was kept on a hilltop for the earliest possible sighting of the royal fleet. As days went by without Olaf appearing, the tension grew. More days passed than had been counted on as likely, and yet he did not come. The waiting became unendurable. There were many theories about the delay, many disputes in which tempers were lost. Theobrand was asked, as an authority, what he thought was the reason. He explained, loftily and patiently, like a great teacher to inquiring children, that affairs of state often take more time than even a king expects, and that loyal subjects must have faith that it is for the general good. When he was asked again and yet again, he became less patient, then annoyed and furious, then screamed at his questioners that they had better stop harassing him or they would regret it. He took to going to the hilltop himself for a look at the sea. During his first day of watching there, the very fact that he was doing it himself filled him with smug confidence, as if the trouble had been that others did not really know how to watch. During his second day, he was suddenly seized with a hideous vision. He saw himself, clad in rags, back in his cave in the Scilly Islands. It vanished almost at once, but left him shaken. That humble estate, which had contented him in the days of his innocence, was a horror when seen from the eminence he had attained. Thinking it over in bed that night, he realized that it had occurred because of a preposterous fear that Olaf might not come to Iceland. Therefore, when he returned to the hill for his third day's watch, he was as grim and unyielding towards himself as to any of the others. He tolerated no doubts. Olaf would arrive soon. Every distant seabird was mistaken for a mast appearing over the horizon. But another day passed, and another, and still Olaf did not come to Iceland. Olaf never came to Iceland. They waited yet more days before they found out why. That was when, instead of the vast fleet with which they had expected Olaf to overwhelm their eyes, only one vessel arrived. And on it was not Olaf, but Sigurd the bishop. It was late at night when his ship was beached, and none were there to greet him, since it was taken for granted that the royal fleet would enter the harbor by day and not risk the dangers of an unknown coast in the dark. But Sigurd had his own reasons for haste. With a few of his men, he came ashore at once, stopping at the first house they reached to ask where Theobrand lived, and then was on his way in the direction indicated before news got around that strangers had landed. Theobrand was awakened by the sound of someone pounding on his front door and a vaguely familiar voice calling him by name. He leapt out of his bed, thinking a messenger had come to tell him that the royal fleet was sighted, and wondering confusedly as he rubbed the sleep out of his eyes why it was therefore night instead of day. He was putting on his clothes, still not fully awake, when a servant came to tell him that Bishop Sigurd and his men were waiting to see him. This roused him to frantic action. He gave orders to light the fire and the torches and dressed himself as fast as his nervous hands would permit. cursing this sudden arrival which had caught him unaware after all. Not daring to keep Olaf, as he thought, waiting, he completed his attire less neatly than he would have wished and ran to the guest hall, clasping his cloak about his neck as he did. The servants had obeyed his orders. Torches and fire were burning as he burst into the hall, with an apology ready on his lips. He stopped short with it unsaid when he saw no one but Sigurd and a half dozen warriors. True, that was all the servants had said were there, but he had not taken it literally and expected all the king's party. He and Sigurd regarded one another in silence for a moment, and then the bishop burst into a roar of laughter which amazed his men, since they knew the dire things he had come to tell Theobrand. "My brand of God is blazing like the sunset," he cried. "Wait," he commanded as Theobrand knelt to kiss his ring. "Turn around a few times and let me enjoy this sight." Theobrand, confused by the strange order, obeyed it. Then the bishop held out the great jewel for him to kiss, saying as he did, "Don't begrudge my laughter. This is very likely the last pleasant moment that will ever be granted to me. And to you too, my poor brother, whom I should have left in peace in your safe, damp cave." He indicated with a wave of his hand that his attendants were to leave. "Has the king come with you?" asked Theobrand when they were alone. "Only in my thoughts," replied Sigurd. "He is following?" asked Theobrand. "No." "He has been detained in Norway?" "He has been detained indeed, but not in Norway." "Why, where is he then?" "In heaven or hell," said Sigurd, "according to the way his deeds are being measured." He waited, watching Theobrand try to make some sense of this, and then, seeing by his sudden pallor that he was making more sense of it than was bearable, he said, "There, the point of the sword is in your heart. The rest won't hurt so much." A jug of wine stood on the great dining table, with its attendant drinking horns encircling it. Sigurd filled two of them and handed one to Theobrand, saying, "A little wine for your stomach's sake. Your stomach will need to be strong, my brother. It already feels as if its bottom has dropped out," said Theobrand piteously, and sat. They drained their horns, refilled them, and the bishop continued. "You need not be told that it is more than pleasure that brings me to this utmost island of the world, at night, without the king. Not that I am without delight in seeing my brand of God again, and knowing that he has not had to wait for heaven to get some of his rewards." Theobrand understood the mild censure and wished he were otherwise arrayed, but he was too disturbed to dwell on that. He only said, "I see that something grave must have happened." "So grave," said Sigurd, leaning forward to impress it on him, "that the only place in all the Northland wherein our faith still has a hold is here." "In Iceland?" queried Theobrand, astonished. "In only one part of Iceland, and in only one part of that part. I mean here, in this house, in this room, at this table, in these two chairs." "But there were so many. Have they all..." Theobrand could neither grasp it nor say it. "The Lord giveth," replied the bishop, "and in this case it may be Odin who taketh away." He crossed himself, feeling he had blasphemed. "Have they all gone back to Odin?" Theobrand faltered. "I do not see how that can be. They seem so ready to take the faith." "Not all, not yet. Perhaps they never will." Sigurd adopted a more serious manner, fearing that his perverse levity, which was a sort of anchor for his own sanity, might be bringing terror to his priest. "It will all turn out as God wills. In the meantime, we, being human, must work with what we know. At this moment, I am sure only of ourselves." He put strength and courage into his voice, for his own benefit as much as Theobrand's. And we too shall be sufficient if our faith is great. There was a time when Peter was alone, and yet he was sufficient. Amen, murmured Theobrand without conviction. Our numbers do not matter. There might have been 2 million, or 2,000, or 200 on whom we could count. We happen to be two, so two it is. 2 million trees shall flower once again from these two humble seeds. Amen, said Theobrand again. But is the case as desperate as that? You shall judge. Perhaps I am too despondent. When first I heard the unhappy news, I thought of you, Brand of God, and how it was my fault that you have stormy days ahead. As it unfolds itself to me, who am none too good a prophet, you will have to swim against the stream that has carried you. For myself, I shall try to mend our fences here and there, and hope other places, as long as my men are willing to ferry me about. I hope everywhere to leave blocks of granite behind. Such as yourself, standing until the wind shall change again. Here, then, is what has happened. Without it, we should have been too easily triumphant and vain. In that eternally damned heathen religion which both of us once followed, we were told of a great battle that would be fought on the last day, in which Odin and his fellow demons were to be defeated. Yes, said Theobrand, the Battle of Ragnarok. Well, said Sigurd, that battle has been fought, but it is now called the Battle of Svold, and the demons have won it. However, the difference ends there, for it may well be the last day, for you and me, at least. Another long drink, for his own stomach's sake, and Bishop Sigurd told his priest the story of the Battle of Svold, which was the most famous sea battle of what we call olden times, in which Christians fought like heathen and heathen like Christian, showing that at bottom there was very little difference between them, except that one of them won and the other lost.